Media 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I am the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound, and it can also be heard streaming live worldwide on WVOX.com. One can call into WVOX at 914-636-0110, but as I say each week, please stay germane to our subject. My guest is Professor Ann Sarah Rubin of the University of Maryland, located in Baltimore, and she is the author of the prize-winning book, A Shattered Nation, The Rise and Fall of the Confederacy. And our subject today is the enduring myths regarding Southern secession. Welcome, Professor Rubin, to The Advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. You know, meanwhile, as I say each week, the mission of The Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. The rejection of slavery and the rights of citizenship to former slaves was affirmed by the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, and it obviously is the public policy of the United States. Our guest, Ann Sarah Rubin, is an associate professor of history at the University of Maryland. She's a graduate of Princeton University with a bachelor's degree. She was awarded her MA and PhD from the prestigious University of Virginia. Her book, A Shattered Nation, The Rise and Fall of the Confederacy, received the 2006 Avery O. Craven Award from the Organization of American Historians for the most original book on the Civil War era. She was a co-author of the award-winning Valley of the Shadow, an interactive history of the Civil War in two communities. She's currently working on a multimedia study of the memory of Sherman's March entitled Through the Heart of Dixie, Sherman's March in America, for which she received a 2007 ACLS Digital Innovation Fellowship. Her website can be found at www.shermansmarch.org. This year, on April 12, 2011, not too many weeks from now, we will mark the 150th anniversary of the start of the American Civil War that began with the firing on Fort Sumter from the batteries located in Charleston, South Carolina. Coincidentally, on this day in 1945, 89 years later, our 32nd president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, passed away also. Since the end of the Civil War, which is what the South calls the war between the states, certain myths about secession have emerged, and interestingly, a majority of people believe in many of these myths. The major myth is that it wasn't slavery that caused secession, but other factors. With that in mind, Professor Rubin, could you frame the conditions that drove slave and free states apart during the 1850s?
Sure. The biggest issue over the 1850s, really the issue that dominated politics through the 1850s, was the expansion of slavery into the Western territories. So into the area that is present-day Kansas and Nebraska, and then also further west, all of the territories that the United States gained during the Mexican War. And the issue was whether slavery should be allowed into any of those territories. The Missouri Compromise from 1820 had decreed that slavery could only exist south of Missouri, which is 36 degrees, 30 minutes. But basically, that policy changes over the course of the 1850s. And what I think the real issue was had to do with kind of visions of what America would look like, that for Southerners, they wanted the ability to expand slavery, which is both a social system for them as well as an economic system. For Northerners, it wasn't so much that they were morally opposed to slavery. Many of them were, but many of them saw slavery as unfair economic competition. Mm. And so I do think the one thing that's important to keep in mind when we talk about slavery and racial policies during the 1850s, 1860s, is that you could be both opposed to slavery and opposed to black equality. And that was the position that most Northern people held.
So basically what was transpiring in this period was the South looking at the potential hegemony of the North on a legislative basis that could theoretically outvote the South, vote out slavery. And also you see not only an expansionist idea of the South in terms of having more slave states to vote in Congress, but they're also interested, many of them, in expanding into Cuba and Mexico. Is that true?
Yes, that's absolutely true. There were these filibustering expeditions into Cuba, and there was a lot of interest in Mexico. There was also interest in Nicaragua as ways to expand slavery overseas. But I do think the political question is a very important one, because the Three-Fifths Compromise in the Constitution actually gave slaveholding states disproportionate political power. But by the 1850s, that could no longer counteract the rising population of the North, of the free states. And so the free states had, I believe it was a 61-seat majority in the House of Representatives by the 1850s. They had remained equal in the Senate because as states had come into the Union, they tended to come in pairs, one slave and one free. What happened was the Compromise of 1850, which brought California in as a free state, started to shift that balance so that the slaveholding states were very concerned that they were losing political power and political control. Ironically, though, in the non-slaveholding states, there was a belief in something called the slave power conspiracy, which was that slaveholders were still controlling the levers of government, that they controlled the Supreme Court, for example, that they had powerful influence on even on presidents from non-slaveholding states, presidents like Franklin Pierce and James Buchanan, for example.
And of course, so our audience understands, the Three-Fifths Compromise, which came in the enacting of the Constitution, was to count a slave not completely as a person for census basis, but three-fifths of a person, to give more weight to the size of the South, which was much smaller in population than the North. You know, the election of 1860 is considered one of our most critical and pivotal elections in our history. It split the Democratic Party three ways. It allowed Abraham Lincoln to be elected on basically a new ticket, a six-year-old Republican ticket. How did the white Southerners react to Abraham Lincoln's election?
Well, white Southerners are obviously quite upset by Lincoln's election, because this was a sign. Lincoln was elected without a single electoral vote from the South, and so this is a sign then, this is the culmination of their fears of disproportionate of their political power completely slipping away. There's a range of ways that white Southerners react. Some of them are what are known as immediate secessionists. That's people from South Carolina, for example, who 6 weeks after Lincoln was elected voted unanimously to secede.
Day before
and you
Christmas.
Do have the seven Deep South states that secede before Lincoln is even inaugurated, because, of course, the inauguration won't take place until March 4th. Then what you have is a group of Southern whites who want to be more cautious, and they are called conditional unionists. And what they wanted to do was keep the Union together, but take a sort of wait-and-see approach and see what Lincoln does. And they were concentrated in the upper South states, so in Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, Arkansas, places like that.
So there was basically, there wasn't a unanimity in opinion, you'd say. There was all sorts of views.
Yes, there was a broader range of opinion, I think, at the time, over the course of that secession winter. So there's a lot, there's a very broad range of opinion, say, November to April, where particularly, for example, in Virginia, they look at the map. They know that should slave states and free states go to war, that war is going to be fought in Virginia, and that's not going to be good for them.
Right.
So they want to avoid any kind of conflict. I think two people in the Upper South, again, say if you live in Virginia, your commercial ties, your economic ties are going to be more with the North. You're going to be shipping your goods, for example, through Baltimore or through even Philadelphia.
Right. You know, Lincoln was supported by Northern abolitionists, and they and he had become famous with his remarkable speech and well-known, A House Divided Against Itself Cannot Stand. We all remember that from our history classes. His election did not automatically mean the institution of slavery could be ended. In the moment or so before our break, how did the white Southerners justify secession? This is one of the essential parts of the myths. What was their justification in their words at that time?
Their justification actually is a pretty legitimate reading of the Constitution. I always tell my students that the only reason secession seems crazy to us now is because we fought the Civil War. But they believed that the Union was a compact and that states had given their powers to the Federal Union when they signed the Constitution, and therefore they could take those powers back. And in fact, the way, if you read the ordinances of secession, the way that states seceded was by rescinding ratification of the Constitution.
Mm. All right. You know, it's very interesting, of course, because and the real opinion of that time we're going to go into after the break. But we're coming up against a short financial news update. And I want to remind our audience, they're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM, live streaming worldwide on WVOX.com. And my guest is author and historian, Professor Ann Sarah Rubin. And our subject in this 150th anniversary year of the start of the American Civil War is the enduring myths of secession. After the break, I'll ask Professor Rubin again, maybe she can reiterate more on this. Why did the Upper South states wait to secede, and what changed their minds? We'll be back in a minute or so.
Business news at 20 minutes past the hour, every hour. Here's the latest update from the Fox Business Network on WVOX Worldwide and WVIP HD2. The winter weather is harsh.
Good heavens, what a terrible curse.
Keep warm with a hot spot on your radio.
Very hot.
VOX.
WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates with my guest, Professor Ann Sarah Rubin. Before the break, I asked my guest this question. Professor Rubin, why did the Upper South, those states, Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, and even Arkansas, wait to secede? And what changed their minds?
They waited to secede because they wanted to at least let Lincoln take office before they made any decisions. And Lincoln had always held the position that while he was opposed to the expansion of slavery into Western territories, he had no problem with allowing slavery to remain in existence in the states where it existed. And so they want to sort of see if he'll make good on that. They also recognize that by staying in the Union, their slaves actually are still under that by staying in the Union, they're still subject to the Fugitive Slave Law, which means that should their slaves run away to a free state, they were obligated to be returned. And they recognize that, for example, should they secede from the Union, the Fugitive Slave Law would no longer apply.
Right.
What changes really is what happens in mid-April, which is that South Carolina troops open fire on Fort Sumter. 36 hours later, on April 14th, they take control of the fort. On April 15th, Abraham Lincoln issues a call for 75,000 state militiamen to be put into federal service, essentially like federalizing the National Guard today, in order to put down this rebellion. And that's the straw. That's the line that these Upper South states were unwilling to cross, which is that they were not willing to take up arms against other slaveholding states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so those four states, Virginia, North Carolina, Arkansas, and Tennessee, all secede pretty quickly after that. That being said, though, there were still slaveholding states that remained in the Union. Delaware still had, I think, about 300 slaves. Maryland had a pretty substantial slave population. Missouri and Kentucky all stayed in the Union.
But they still had slaves in those states.
They still had slaves in those states. And in fact, slavery was still legal in the District of Columbia until 1862
right.
as well. So.
You know, since the end of the Civil War, Southern revisionists have claimed that slavery was not the prime reason for secession. To what extent was the Civil War a war over slavery? And as ancillary reasons, what about this issue that they seem to promote of states' rights, the right to leave the Union, tariffs, economic hegemony in the North? Could it have happened without slavery if slavery didn't exist?
I think there's no way the Civil War would have happened without slavery being the divisive force that it was. At base, it all comes down to slavery, I think. You know, why did they want states' rights and the ability for their states to, for example, like in the 1830s, nullify federal laws to protect slavery? These tariff issues and economic issues, they did matter. They were part of a constellation of grievances that white Southerners had against the federal union, but nothing overshadowed the role and the importance of slavery. And I have to tell you that the other day a colleague of mine gave me a new pamphlet that the National Park Service has just put out with the title Slavery, Cause and Catalyst of the Civil War.
Mm.
So I think that's pretty much, certainly amongst scholars, that's the accepted position. Other issues did matter, as you say, states' rights or the tariff. It is a long-standing grievances, but I think if you dig beneath the surface of any of those issues, it comes down ultimately to the question of slavery.
How did, North Carolina, as being a state like Mississippi with a majority of African Americans, was
South Carolina,
course,
actually.
South
yeah.
Carolina, pardon me. Was more or less more vulnerable, at least they thought, of retribution. We're going to get into that after the break. But mm-hmm. how did this history of nullification, with John C. Calhoun and Andrew Jackson, did this lay a groundwork for the feeling that the South had the right to leave the Union?
Absolutely. South Carolina, yeah, South Carolinians with the controversy over nullification in the 1830s, but in fact, nullification drew on earlier writings. It drew actually on the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions of 1798, which were written by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison to protest the Alien and Sedition Acts. And they were the ones who first made this case that it was a compact that a state could interpose its authority between its citizens and the federal government. So I guess what I try to get across is actually that I think it's a legitimate reading of the Constitution in 1860 and 61 to believe that states could secede from the Union. I don't think that they necessarily thought out all of the implications of what that would mean. And South Carolina had historically been the home of what were known as the fire eaters, the really rabid pro-Southern nationalists and pro-secessionists. The joke about South Carolina in the mid-19th century, and I'm assuming there aren't too many South Carolinians listening, is that it was too small to be its own country, but too large to be a lunatic asylum.
Very good. Excellent. There may be some South Carolinians. Actually, when you go down to South Carolina along the coast, it's mm-hmm. much different than the interior of the state. It's like two states.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, when you talk about some of these other reasons like tariffs versus the industrialized North, how did the South see itself and what was how strong was the issue of tariffs in the post-rationalization period?
Yeah, I think those economic issues do matter. I think we tend to oversimplify the degree, and we tend to think that, you know, the North was this nation of factories and the South was this pastoral nation of farms and the kind of slow agrarian lifestyle. I think that there was a lot of commercial interest and commercial development in the South. Where Southerners were resentful of tariffs, they were okay with paying revenue tariffs. What they resented were protective tariffs, and these were tariffs basically on cotton in order to protect the domestic textile industry. And so what white Southerners tended to be resentful of was they felt like they were the ones who were bearing the burden of this, and it was Northerners who were getting all of the benefits. And they also believed, and they were actually correct in this, that they were paying more into the U.S. Treasury, for example, than they were getting out of the U.S. Treasury.
And of course, one of the later we can get into, one of the reasons why there was a problem in perception today about the slavery being a moribund institution is that 75% of our exports were coming from the South.
Mm-hmm.
And where in the North, which had the canals, it had the rails, it had industrialization, the Northern people had a tendency to be greater protectionists.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It was sort of interesting that this protectionism, which is an issue today. I mean, we've had the issue running through industrialized countries for hundreds of years. And in fact, one of the leading problems that led to the Depression was considered the Smoot-Hawley tariff.
Right.
That was passed. And most of us believe that we would like to have international trade, but we'd also like to have a little bit of a trade surplus, you know, when it goes the other way. Of course, that doesn't always happen. We have to break for a commercial, and
okay.
I want to remind our audience that they're listening to WVOX 1460 AM. We're live streaming on WVOX with my guest, Professor Ann Sarah Rubin, historian, author of the prize-winning book, A Shattered Nation, The Rise and Fall of the Confederacy. And we've been talking about the enduring myths of secession. When we come back from the break, I'm going to ask Professor Rubin the following question. Why did the Southern non-slaveholders, those individuals who did not own slaves, fight for the Confederacy? We'll be back in a moment.
National news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Ron Flatter. Two Iranian warships arriving in the Mediterranean maybe in just a few hours have Israel watching and weighing a possible response. The two ships are said to be en route to Syria, reportedly to establish a permanent presence. The Israeli Foreign Ministry telling Fox News they pose a grave threat to stability in the Middle East. A convicted pirate from Somalia gets nearly 34 years in prison in America. Abdulwali Moussay sentenced today in New York after being captured by the U.S. Navy nearly 2 years ago.
The first people I want to thank are the SEALs. They're the superheroes, and they did the impossible with me.
Richard Phillips, shortly after his rescue in 2009, his cargo ship was attacked by pirates off Africa's east coast. Moussay was the only suspect captured alive. He was a teenager at the time of the attack, perhaps as young as 16 years old. Fox News. We report, you decide.
I'm not comfortable with this. I think Jason should go to college now. I don't want him putting this off. He's already talked to a recruiter. Could you just talk some sense into it?
I understand, but I think if you just listen to him, you'll see. His decision makes a whole lot of sense. He wants to go to college right now, but he also wants to serve. That's why he's been talking to a National Guard recruiter.
The National Guard gives young men and women the unique opportunity to serve their country and communities part-time while they attend college.
You know, we've also got to figure out how we're going to pay for all this. The way things are these days, tuition, room and board, they're through the roof. And with our finances...
No, honey, don't worry. He's worked that out with the Guard recruiter, too.
Plus, with the National Guard scholarship and other financial benefits, college students can graduate debt-free. Get to know what serving in the National Guard can do for your son or daughter. Visit NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the New York National Guard, aired by the New York State Broadcasters Association and this station.
All the families and our friends at Jeffrey Park Apartments in Scarsdale remind listeners that many children across America are reported missing each day. So parents, let your children know that strangers can be dangerous, and if you have any information concerning a missing child, call your local authorities. This reminder, courtesy of the family and our friends with the Jeffrey Park Apartments in Scarsdale. They're on the air doing their part to help locate and bring home our missing children.
Ways of making you talk.
This is a crazy man.
WVOX Worldwide.
WVOX.
Now, back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to the Advocates and my guest, Professor Ann Sarah Rubin. We're discussing the myths about the Civil War. We are in the 150th sesquicentennial year. The Civil War broke out in South Carolina with the firing on Fort Sumter on April 12th. It's only a month and a half or so from this period of time. In the South before the Civil War, a small percentage of Southerners owned slaves. Some people use the statistics of 5%. There were other areas where there are more. Before the break, I asked Professor Rubin, therefore, why did non-slaveholders fight for the Confederacy? Why would they support this despised institution, Professor Rubin?
Yeah, that's really the big question that a lot of people have. And I think the reason that so many non-slaveholders fought in the Civil War was simply that they didn't despise slavery. Slavery was a system that benefited them. It was a system that granted all white men a level of status. It was the major way to get ahead in Southern society was to invest in slaves, and that a lot of people who didn't own slaves personally certainly had family members who did. They might have hoped to eventually buy their way into the slaveholding class. And I think also there's a degree to which slavery was also, of course, it sounds silly to say, but it was really about white supremacy, and that this notion that if slavery didn't exist, there would be race war, there would be chaos, and that that also was something that non-slaveholders were fighting to protect. Mm.
Now, to follow this up, and it's a, I think, a critical point regarding race supremacy and the fear of the specter of free slaves frightening Southerners. Now, it isn't a stretch to believe that once African Americans had their freedom, they would attain citizenship. Now, was there a thought that they would seek retribution over against the white former slaveholders? Was there a perception of that?
Yes, absolutely. That is one of the great fears and one of the great arguments in favor of preserving slavery is that after centuries and centuries of being mistreated at the hands of Southern whites, how could African Americans not rise up and extract retribution? Thomas Jefferson, having gone to the University of Virginia, I think I'm contractually obligated to throw in a Jefferson quote at any chance I get, but Jefferson wrote at one point regarding this fear of what would happen if slavery ended. He said, "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and that his justice cannot sleep forever." So it's a fear, but it's also a fear that is largely unfounded, because African Americans don't rise up and extract that kind of vengeance on whites. They don't do it because they know that the world around them is stacked against them. They don't do it because it's morally wrong. But it is an enormous part of this kind of pro-slavery, pro-Confederate argument is this fear of racial violence.
You know, the Georgia Supreme Court Justice Henry Benning at the time, who was trying to persuade the Virginia legislator to leave the Union, predicted race war if slavery was not protected. He said the consequence will be that our men will all be exterminated or expelled to wander as vagabonds over a hostile earth. And for our women, their fate will be too horrible to contemplate, even in fancy. And many even expressed the destruction of Christianity. Is this sort of hyperbole, or do they believe this?
I think it's a combination of hyperbole and belief, because, I mean, this is the sort of perennial fear of the slaveholders, that they're going to be murdered in their beds, or that they're going to be poisoned, or, you know. So I think there's an element of that. I think what's, of course, ironic about it is after the Civil War is over, during Reconstruction, there is race war, there is horrible violence. Thousands upon thousands of people are killed in racial violence, but it's whites killing blacks under the auspices of groups like the Ku Klux Klan.
And it's interesting that today South Carolina wants to put General Nathan DeForest on a license plate.
Yeah, Mississippi is doing that.
And they believe that this is an historical person. I think it would be most surprising to find Germany putting Adolf Hitler on a plate and saying, well, he's a part of our history, should be recognized.
Exactly. It is shocking.
And they justify it. There seems to be other myths about the South and secession. One is that slavery was on its last legs, and that Northern monies could have been bought, could buy out African American freedom. Is there any truth to those views?
Not really. Slavery certainly was not on its last legs. It was still tremendously profitable. It was, in fact, the most profitable it had ever been in the 1850s. I just saw something the other day, completely unrelated to the Civil War, but cotton prices are just about to rebound to the levels that they were in the Civil War, when it was $1.89 a pound for cotton in the 1850s, which is incredibly high. So cotton was tremendously profitable. Slavery was tremendously profitable.
And they encouraged the birth of more slaves.
It was a system where there was a lot of money to be made. The wealthiest people in the United States in 1860 were slaveholders. So now, in terms of compensation and compensated emancipation, that is actually how the District of Columbia, I believe, emancipated its slaves, with some limited compensation. I don't think that would have been feasible. I mean, there were 4 million enslaved people in the United States. I don't think that would have been feasible to have it be a fully compensated emancipation.
So, in other words, by 1860, it was not moribund. It wasn't on its last legs, and it was growing more entrenched.
Absolutely.
Right.
There were geographic shifts in it, though, and that did provoke also some more anxiety, I think, among Deep South slaveholders, so that states like Maryland, for example, had become slave exporters. Slaves were being sold from Maryland into Louisiana, Texas, places like that. So the sort of center of slavery was shifting further and further south, but it's in no way a moribund institution. It was in no danger of dying out on its own.
Now, also, getting away from the myths and part of the reality, there was the well-known underground railway system that brought free slaves. There was a number of revolts going on. We know, of course, the most famous was Nat Turner's revolt. But how effective was the fugitive slave law, and how often was it used?
The fugitive slave law was actually more effective as abolitionist propaganda, because as it was written coming out of the Compromise of 1850, it was so egregiously biased in favor of slaveholders that it wound up inflaming Northerners, who felt that now they were all being turned into slave catchers. Very few, I don't know the statistics off the top of my head, but very few people would really bother to go through the trouble and expense of tracking down a runaway slave who had been able to make it all the way to the North, particularly, again, if you're a slaveholder in Louisiana. The chances, first of all, of your slave making it to the North are so slim, and it was too much trouble and too much expense. There, I think the number given for successful runaway slaves is only around 50,000.
Mm.
It's not particularly high, actually.
Now, you know, there's also part of the enduring dual myths. We have D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, which is seen today as a very racist film, may have some historical accuracy, and of course, Gone with the Wind. How did, were there divisions in terms of what is generally known as the field slave and the house slave? How did they react to slavery, these two different distinctive groups?
I think, first of all, they're not as different and distinctive as we might think. That particularly in slave holdings that were large, you had people living in family groups. You had, you might have a field slave who's married to somebody who works in the house. I think there's a lot of, you could make an argument that one form of slavery was harsher than another. I think, though, that in general, if you worked in the house, you perhaps had better living conditions. You might have better food, better clothing, but you're also in much more close proximity to the master and the whims of the master, and so you also often suffered a lot more physical violence, beatings, and things like that.
And also sexual abuse.
Yes, no. Sexual abuse. If you worked in the fields, your labor was hard, but you had perhaps a little bit more autonomy.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting because a part of this, and we'll discuss this in the last segment of our show, is possibly why Southern blacks fought for the Confederacy. We have to break for a commercial, and I want to remind our audience that they're listening to WVOX 1460 AM. We're live streaming worldwide on WVOX.com and discussing in this 150th anniversary year of the start of the American Civil War, the enduring myths regarding secession with Professor Ann Sarah Rubin. We'll be back in a moment or so in our last segment. Thank you.
National news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lillian Wu. He attacked a U.S. flagship, and now a Somali pirate gets the book thrown at him in a New York court.
33 years and 9 months. That's how long Abdulwali Moussaei will spend in prison. His attorneys were hoping for 27 years, but a federal judge says she wanted to send a message to other would-be pirates.
Fox Radio's Todd Starnes in Manhattan.
Moussaei pleaded guilty last year to a number of charges in connection with the taking of a merchant ship in the Indian Ocean back in 2009. Two sailors died.
She's still recovering from the gunshot wound to the head, but congressional friends of Representative Gabrielle Giffords are holding a fundraiser next month for her 2012 election. Her family and staff have reported she can walk the halls of the hospital where she's staying holding a cart and can mouth the words to simple songs. And on Wall Street, stocks higher on stronger earnings and another round of corporate deals. Fox News, we report, you decide.
The Performing Arts Center at Purchase College invites you to join Bill McLaughlin as the host of an intimate and interactive afternoon with virtuoso violinist Daniel Hope and pianist Jeffrey Kahani. Sunday, February 20th at 3 p.m. The youngest ever member of the Beaux Arts Trio, Hope has toured the world as a soloist for many years. He is renowned for his musical versatility and creativity. With Kahani, he will perform works by Brahms, Messiaen, Schulhoff, and Franck. There will be an opportunity for listening, questioning, and commentary, and a reception with the artists following the show. Tickets for Daniel Hope and Jeffrey Kahani at the Performing Arts Center can be reserved by calling 914-521-6200 or at www.artscenter.org. That's 914-521-6200 or at artscenter.org.
No matter where you go.
Driving in truck all day long.
Driving to work.
We're right there with you. WVOX Worldwide.
WVOX.
Now, back
to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates with my guest, Professor Ann Sarah Rubin, author and historian. We've been talking about the myths of secession coming up early April, April 12th. It will be the 150th anniversary of the start of the Civil War. There are people still debating the reasons, North and South, mostly in the South, I think, who would like to wish to control the argument. Professor Rubin, there's been a view that Abraham Lincoln went to war to end slavery. Of course, and in fact, the South had already seceded, and Lincoln had even stated in a letter to the New York Tribune that his main reason was to save the Union. What was the truth about Lincoln's reasons, and did he mask his anti-slavery thinking to help him unify the country to fight the war and not make the slaves the primary issue?
Yeah, I mean, I take Lincoln at his word when in the summer of 1862 he writes to Horace Greeley that if he could save the Union by freeing all the slaves, he would, and if he could save the Union by freeing none of the slaves, he would, and if he could save the Union by freeing some and not freeing others, that's what he would do. I don't think he was a sort of closeted abolitionist. I think Lincoln was very much emblematic of most people of his time, which is to say that he thought that racial slavery was morally wrong, but that he also could not really conceive of African Americans as worthy of and deserving of the full rights of equality and citizenship. I also think, and this again is something I really emphasize when I teach, that Lincoln is somebody who changes over the course of the war, and his attitudes towards African Americans change over the course of the war, so that he uses emancipation as a war-related maneuver. He needs to strike at the Southern economy. African Americans helped the Confederate economy because, of course, they were able to stay at home and work while white men went off and fought. Many of them also were impressed into service in the Confederate Army, digging ditches and building fortifications and things like that. But I think the experience for Lincoln after emancipation of ultimately allowing African American men to serve in the Union Army, and 186,000 men served in the Army and the Navy, I think really changes his view and his attitudes towards equality for blacks. He certainly pushes very hard to get the 13th Amendment through, and was certainly willing to allow at least for some full citizenship rights, or full citizenship rights for some African Americans. Yeah.
Professor Rubin, we have a caller. Go ahead, caller, please, and state your name.
It's Mr. Cam from New Rochelle.
What's on your mind?
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
Will tell you shortly. I'd like to get a little more controversial here. I understand that Ben Franklin had two slaves, and there must have been widespread slaveholding in the North. Farmers probably had a slave or so as a helper. Wealthy people probably had other house servants, and the white working class definitely got used to the idea that they were superior and they should have access to better jobs. And then I want to kind of fast forward to today with affirmative action that has failed utterly, and that African American working class men have no access to union jobs to speak of.
Well, what's your question, Mr. Kemp?
If you just give me a
question.
Couple more sentences,
I know, but
out
give
of the
us
whole hour, I'm just about there.
Okay, good.
Now, so I want to know if you think that this has corrupted the northern working class man the same way it did the southerner to feel superior, to be racist, and as de Tocqueville said, it would be the most difficult problem America would have to face. Do you think this has kind of gotten us stuck in this racist environment in the North?
Thank you for your call. Go ahead, Professor Rubin.
I think that's basically right. I think that's basically true. Slavery did exist in the North. It was present in all of the 13 original colonies. It's not abolished, for example, in New York until 1828. And what you did have certainly was a lot of racial tension. There were very, very few people in the North, even a lot of people who were opposed to slavery on moral grounds. did not believe in equality for blacks. African Americans, there was no universal suffrage for African American men in northern states, or perhaps only in Massachusetts, actually. Let me correct myself there. It certainly was an issue, and I think it played into the ultimate failure of Reconstruction, which is that you didn't have the Northerners didn't support a lot of radical Reconstruction and a lot of the proposals for black equality and racial equality either. And I think we know certainly from the 20th century that it was as much of a challenge to eradicate segregation in Northern schools, where it was de facto segregation, as it was to eliminate it in Southern schools.
De jure.
De jure. So,
how did, in regards to this, the contribution of African Americans, how did they change the course of the war, and why did some of them fight for the South?
Well, the very, very few African Americans fought for the South. This is a hugely controversial issue. There's very little evidence for blacks who willingly joined up and fought for the Confederacy.
So that's another myth. Another myth.
It is a huge myth. There were some, for example, who were impressed into service. There were a couple of units of free blacks who enlisted in the Confederacy, and then, for example, when Louisiana came under Union occupation, switched sides and fought for the Union. For African Americans who fought for the Union, they really did it to, first of all, free slaves, of course, to contribute to this war, and as a way of proving, I think, their masculinity, as a way of proving their worthiness for citizenship. I actually, it's a rare Civil War movie that I like, but I actually think the movie Glory from late 80s does a pretty good job of capturing those big issues or the reasons that African American men fought. And I think it goes a long way to getting the Union Army behind emancipation and behind some modicum of racial equality.
No doubt. Glory is a very entertaining film, and if anybody visits the Boston State Capitol on Beacon Street, one can walk just across the street and see this huge bronze plaque to Colonel Shaw, mm-hmm. who was a type of from the Boston white elite, who led black soldiers in that division and actually gave his life for the cause of the North. Getting back to the South here, and of course their idea of victory was different from the North. They would have attained victory by secession, but the North's goals were not stalemate, but forcible reunion. Was a Union victory inevitable?
Yes. I do think a Union victory was inevitable, although the Confederacy comes pretty close to... The Confederacy is more successful, I think, than we would have expected it to be. I think ultimately Union victory was inevitable just because the Union was so much larger. It had a much larger population. It had many more resources, and it really could outlast the Confederates.
Mm.
They just couldn't... You know, they had mobilized something along the lines of 90% of their eligible male population, and they were done. They had no one else to fight.
If Lee had not surrendered at Appomattox, do you think that a ongoing war, a kind of insurrection, could have led to almost a draconian peace that would made Reconstruction look like a picnic?
I think Robert E. Lee surrendered. Sherman was on the heels of Joe Johnston. I mean, I think even if Lee had been able to hold out for a couple more weeks, the war was over by then.
So, in other words, their official surrender really says to everybody, lay down your arms because this is becoming pointless.
Right. And I mean, Lee's surrender, we point to that as the biggest moment. There were Confederate armies in the field until late May of 1865, and Jefferson Davis himself is on the run and is not captured until May 10th.
Mm.
But I think it was the big moment that said this is never going to work.
Right,
you know, it's never going to happen.
You know, after the war, the Southern spinmeisters, a modern term, and apologists start a campaign to create a new rationalization about the causes for the war. And on the other hand, the North wanted reconciliation, obviously. Did this attitude contribute to the problems of Reconstruction? And by the way, was it a complete failure caused mostly by copperheads and carpetbaggers? Do you think it was a failure?
I think Reconstruction is largely a failure. I don't think it's a failure because of the Union. I don't think you can really place the blame on Northerners. I think Reconstruction ultimately fails because there is such a powerful backlash from Southern whites who do everything in their power to destroy it and who ultimately succeed through campaigns of terror and violence and intimidation. And I also think that white Northerners do, eventually they had fatigue. They were tired of talking about, you know, what they would call the Southern question or the Negro question, and they needed to go back and rebuild their lives, and you have a lot of other issues coming into play in the 1860s and 1870s. You have the panic and financial panic and corruption, and so I think Northerners get tired of it, and white Southerners are able to regain control. I think the only sort of real good that comes out of Reconstruction is it's a sort of certainly the legacy of the amendments, and I think the kind of memory for African Americans that there was this period of time where there was a sort of chance for equality that inspires them to keep going and keep struggling.
Professor Rubin, I want to thank you for giving us a wonderfully enlightening hour. It was great to have such a distinguished guest joining me and gracing the studios and our airways. I thank you very much for coming on, and let's hope that the next 150 years are a little bit better in terms of putting our country together. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Yeah. Next week, I'll be discussing infamous criminal cases and their impact on New York with author and private investigator Miss C.C. McNair. We're going to talk about some of the cases that affected New York in the last decade or so. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocates broadcasts, you can access them on my website, advocates-wvox.com, where the information my guests will be posted. Again, thank you, Professor Rubin, and have a great day. Thanks a lot. Bye.